Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the June 4th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is set in front of the U.S. Supreme Court building. In the foreground are the three newest justices holding up signs. Brett Kavanaugh has a sign that says, "Stop Abortion Now." Amy Coney Barrett has one that says, "Hashtag Team Life." And Neil Gorsuch is holding one up over his head that says, "Protect Unborn Life." In the background between them and the building itself, it looks like Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas are holding up a clenched fist in solidarity. And the headline is, "The End of Roe, a Strong Signal from the New Conservative Justices." And I believe we picked that up on the controversy of the week, but we will start with the first main story. A ceasefire in Israel and Gaza, but no peace. What happened? Israelis and Palestinians began repairing the damage and considering the path forward this week after 11 days of fighting ended in a ceasefire that few expected would lead to lasting peace. The worst violence in Gaza since 2014 killed 248 Palestinians, including 66 children, according to Palestinian health officials. Hamas fired more than 4,300 rockets, most of them intercepted by Iron Dome defense missiles, and killed dozens of Israelis, including two children. Israeli airstrikes left Gaza severely damaged, with hundreds of buildings destroyed, 17 hospitals and scores of schools damaged, hundreds of thousands cut off from electricity and clean water. Israeli officials said more than 200 Hamas militants had been killed and more than 60 miles of Hamas underground tunnel network destroyed. But Israeli hawks and many residents said the ceasefire came too soon. "The mission wasn't completed," said Michael Kutzker. Mikhail Kutzker, a mother of four in Ashkelon, "Nothing has changed. Many Palestinians claimed victory, but they faced a humanitarian crisis with no change to the Israeli blockade, settlement policy in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, or other conditions. We live in death every day as long as there is an occupation," said Ramez al-Masri, whose Gaza home was reduced to a crater. In hopes of firming up the ceasefire, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made his first Middle East trip and met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He pledged that the U.S. would reopen its consulate in Jerusalem and otherwise restore diplomatic ties with the Palestinians that were severed under President Trump. "The U.S. is committed to rebuilding the relationship with the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian people," he said. President Biden played down divisions over Israel within the Democratic Party and said, "There is no shift in my commitment to the security of Israel, period." What the editorial said: "The bloodshed has ended for now, but the hard work of resolving the Palestinian issue remains," said USA Today. "The bitterness and hatred that led to the violence has been stoked by Jewish settlers' steady encroachment into the West Bank and East Jerusalem. A provocative Israeli police raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and a Palestinian leadership unable or unwilling to negotiate peace." President Biden has his hands full on both foreign and domestic issues, but as a leader of the one world power with a clout to be an honest broker of peace, he must try to spark new negotiations. Israel has a right, even a responsibility, to put a stop to rocket attacks at their source, said the New York Times. But its intractable conflict with the Palestinians cannot be bombed away. It is in no one's interest, including Israel's, for another generation of Palestinians to grow up in misery and under blockade and periodic bombardment, which only strengthens the grip of Hamas radical leaders. Both Israel and the Palestinians have given up on a two-state solution, but there is no viable alternative, and Biden should seek to revive it. What the columnist said. Ceasefires and agreements with Hamas are worthless, said Amir Avivi in WashingtonExaminer.com. The only way forward for Israel is to put the terrorist group's leaders within the crosshairs. They've held the people of Gaza and Israel hostage for 15 years, committing the double war crime of targeting Israeli civilians while using their own people as cover. To focus on Hamas is to miss the point, said Basma Galyayini in the New York Times. For Israel and its defenders, Hamas is the perfect hook on which to hang all blame. But no Palestinian government would accept Palestinians being driven from their homes in East Jerusalem. The conflict isn't about Hamas, it's about the Israeli occupation. And we Palestinians are in this together. This fragile peace will not last, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. Israeli police abuses and far-right vigilantes marching through Jerusalem have stoked a fire among Palestinians that won't be put out easily. More angry resistance is in store, and it won't be limited to Gaza. Pragmatic moderates no longer have any sway either in Israel or among the increasingly radicalized Palestinians. After these bloody 2 weeks, there may be no going back. And our controversy of the week. Abortion, is this the end for Roe? For nearly half a century, Roe versus Wade has guaranteed the right of American women to legal abortion, said Ellie Mistel in TheNation.com. But the Supreme Court has just launched a frontal attack on that precedent. The court last week agreed to hear a challenge to a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The eagerness of a court now dominated by conservatives to even consider the Mississippi law, which every lower court tossed out as unconstitutional, means at least four justices, and probably five or six, are ready to uproot the central finding of Roe and the related 1992 Casey ruling. States cannot restrict abortions if they place an undue burden on women before the point of fetal viability, or roughly 24 weeks. The day progressives have dreaded is here, said Julie Kay and Catherine Colbert in Slate.com. The newest three justices, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, were each groomed by the Federalist Society and handpicked by Donald Trump with the goal of overturning Roe in mind. Together with Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the five ultra-conservative justices don't even need the vote of the more cautious Chief Justice John Roberts to deliver a prize right-wingers have been pursuing for four decades. Roe is going to fall. Let's hope so, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Reasonable people can disagree about whether abortion should be legal. But honest pro-choicers admit Roe was an indefensible decision. To legalize abortion nationwide, the sophist of the 1973 court declared that the taking of unborn human life is a private act, and then invented a right to privacy mentioned nowhere in the Constitution. We pro-lifers dream of an America where all unborn children are protected in law and welcomed in life, said Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. But reversing Roe will only toss the issue back to the states, where voters' elected representatives can give them whatever abortion laws they favor. Both pro-lifers and pro-choicers might wind up disappointed, said Jonah Goldberg in thedispatch.com. The court may have chosen the Mississippi case so as to move the point at which states can restrict abortion to around 15 weeks. This would be denounced as a calamity by abortion rights activists. But given that 90% of abortions take place before 15 weeks, it would arguably make the right to most abortions more constitutionally and politically secure than ever before. But even a partial rollback of abortion rights would inflame a highly emotional issue even further, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. If the mostly settled framework of the last 48 years is discarded, it will give way to a savage landscape of new legal and political battles over abortion laws in dozens of states. American women will pay a heavy price if the court overturns Roe, said Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. But so will the court itself, which will have torched its own institutional legitimacy. For years, we've listened to Supreme Court nominees mouth reassuring platitudes about the importance of precedent and the duty of judges to put personal preferences aside, said David Von Drell in the Washington Post. Those claims are about to be tested. Is the Supreme Court an institution whose authority is built on a firm foundation of previous rulings? Or is it just another partisan body that can reverse course with a simple majority of justices at any given moment? As the court tees up its reconsideration of Roe, we're about to find out. It's a good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for social distancing. After a salmonella outbreak in 43 states prompted a warning from the Centers for Disease Control that people should not kiss or snuggle backyard chickens, even if they look healthy and clean. It was a good week for Vermont, which became the first U.S. state to vaccinate 70% of people 12 and up against COVID. Governor Phil Scott pledged to lift all restrictions as soon as the state gets to 80%. And it was a good week for emerging, with a Wall Street Journal report that deodorant, tooth whiteners, and condoms are flying off the shelves as Americans prepare for their re-entry into civilization. Jen Edwards, 34, an app designer, says she might also need some new clothes because all I've done for the past year is just wear sweatpants. But it was a bad week for CNN's credibility. After network boss Jeff Zucker ordered anchor Chris Cuomo to make an on-air apology rather than face discipline for participating in strategy sessions to help his brother, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, combat sexual assault allegations, Chris Cuomo told viewers it will never happen again. It was a bad week for Hermit Kingdom hipsters. After Kim Jong-un banned North Korean men from wearing skinny jeans. In reporting the ban, the state newspaper warned men against adopting decadent Western clothes and reminded them there are only 15 approved hairstyles. Finally, it was a bad week for Anthony Bouchard, a Wyoming state senator challenging Representative Liz Cheney for her House seat after he confirmed that he impregnated a 14-year-old girl when he was 18. She was a little younger than me, Bouchard said, so it's like the Romeo and Juliet story. And one of the short and other news pieces while we're here. DOJ releases partial memo on Trump obstruction. The Justice Department this week released part of a 2019 memo that then-Attorney General William Barr cited to justify not charging then-President Donald Trump with obstructing justice in connection with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. DOJ lawyers said they would appeal an order to release the full document, which analyzes evidence in the Mueller report that Trump impeded the investigation into Russian election interference. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson earlier this month issued a ruling harshly criticizing Barr, in which she said that he never genuinely weighed the evidence or considered prosecuting Trump, and that the memo's real purpose was getting a jump on public relations before Mueller's report went public. Our briefing in this issue is titled "The Mystery of Havana Syndrome." U.S. officials are investigating possible directed energy attacks on government officials. Who's behind them? What is Havana Syndrome? It's the name given to a mysterious constellation of symptoms that first surfaced among American officials in Havana in 2016. Dozens of diplomats and CIA officers stationed in the U.S. Embassy there began falling ill with vertigo, headaches, fatigue, hearing loss, visual disturbances, cognitive impairment, and other symptoms. Some said at the outset they'd heard clicking and other odd sounds and felt intense pressure in the head. The following year, diplomats and other U.S. officials in Guangzhou, China, reported similar problems. Numerous CIA officers in Asia, Europe, and Australia have been afflicted over the past couple years, according to news accounts. CBS reports that more than a dozen CIA officials have returned to the U.S. for medical care so far this year, many requiring emergency evacuation. In a worrying development, two National Security Council officials reported being struck by Havana-like symptoms near the White House in November. One later told The New Yorker he fell to the ground, couldn't speak, and suddenly felt as if I was going to die. How many people have been affected? The New York Times reported last month that more than 130 Americans have been sickened. The Senate Intelligence Committee said in April that the pattern of attacks appears to be increasing. That same month, Pentagon officials told the House Armed Services Committee they're increasingly worried about possible attacks on U.S. troops in the Middle East and elsewhere. "We have failed to take it seriously as a threat," said Representative Jim Banks, an Indiana Republican on the committee. Do victims' symptoms last? Some say their illness is faded, but others have suffered lasting damage. Doctors at the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Philadelphia, who've treated dozens of victims, published a study describing sustained injury to cognitive, balance, motor, and sensory functions, similar to what's seen in a severe concussion. Mark Polymeropoulos, a 26-year CIA veteran, was forced to retire by injuries suffered on a trip to Moscow in 2017. He awoke in his hotel room with an intense feeling of nausea and vertigo, like I was going to both throw up and pass out at the same time, he said. A former covert operative who'd spent years hunting terrorists in the Middle East, he suffered constant debilitating headaches ever since and was treated for traumatic brain injury at Walter Reed Hospital. "It incapacitates you," he said. "Ultimately, it's a pretty brilliant terror weapon." How are these attacks carried out? It's still not known for sure, but the general consensus is that the attacks involve targeted radio frequency energy, a type of radiation that includes microwaves. A team of experts from the National Academies of Sciences, convened by the State Department, concluded in a report released in December that directed pulsed radio frequency energy was the most plausible mechanism to explain the syndrome. Some skeptics have suggested mass hysteria is behind the symptoms, pointing out that no known directed energy weapon exists and that there's not even a solid theory about how one might work. All the available science suggests that any such weapon would be wildly impractical, wrote Cheryl Roefer, a former chemist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, in Foreign Policy last month. No evidence has been offered to support the existence of this mystery weapon. If the weapon is real, who is wielding it? The U.S. has not officially blamed anyone yet, but all indicators point to Russia and its military intelligence unit, the GRU. The recent National Academies of Sciences report noted that there's been significant research in Russia/USSR on pulsed radio frequency technology. The CIA has used mobile phone data to collect Russian intelligence agents who worked on microwave weapons programs in the same cities where CIA officers were afflicted, according to news reports. These weapons could be small enough to fit inside a van or even a backpack, and could target an individual up to 1,000 yards away, officials believe. It looks, smells, and feels like the GRU, an official involved in the investigation told Politico.com. How is the U.S. responding? Amid growing pressure from lawmakers and victims, the Biden administration has vowed to step up the investigation. CIA Director William Burns, who was queried about the attacks during his confirmation hearings, has met with victims and established a task force on the attacks. The Pentagon and State Department each have their own task forces, and the White House says it's coordinating the agency's studies. Leaders across the intelligence community are focused on this issue, said Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines. With the attacks causing growing anxiety among U.S. diplomats and soldiers around the world, it is absolutely critical that we find out who did this, said Polymeropoulos. The idea of dismissing it outright is just not acceptable anymore. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with one from the U.S. titled, Lightfoot's Progressive Racism. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's latest decision is racist, said Zachary Faria. Lightfoot has decided that she completes her second year in office. She will grant one-on-one interviews only to black and other non-white journalists. Her justification is that Chicago media outlets are too white, and so, in her words, in order to progress, we must change. Diversity may be a worthy goal, but judging the worthiness of every member of the Chicago media solely by their skin color can be described by only one word, racism. The fact that it's progressive racism aimed at achieving equity makes it no less grotesque and anti-American. Lightfoot may have created this divisive identity politics distraction to drown out coverage of her abysmal leadership in the Windy City. So far this year, there have been 227 homicides in Chicago, 36 more than its blood-soaked pace in 2020, and the dead include 185 black people and 66 Hispanics. That's far more important than the race of people covering the news, because Lightfoot's kind of woke racism has become mainstream among progressives and leaders of the Democratic Party, she has received almost no criticism for discriminating against white reporters. But it shouldn't be shrugged off. This column comes from Iceland. The headline caught my eye. Should we pay for housewives' vacations? As the pandemic eases and people once more start planning vacations, said Kristen Hakur Gudnason, the concept of housewives' leave has again become a sore point. The idea that women homemakers should get paid time off, just like any other Icelandic worker, was enshrined in law in 1960, at the dawn of the modern women's rights movement. Since then, each local town has sent the few dozen housewives who've applied on an annual little jaunt, sometimes to another part of Iceland, sometimes abroad. Last year, all such trips were canceled, along with the rest of Icelanders' international travel plans. And now that borders are open, many officials don't want to pay for what they see as a pointless perk from a sexist past that Iceland has long since left behind. The leave is based on a 19th century way of thinking and has nothing to do with equality, said Gunnar Einarsson, mayor of Gardabær. His council actually tried to refuse to pay for a holiday committee, but was overruled by regional authorities. Einarsson is not the only objector. Many lawmakers supported a bill to scrap housewives' leaves in 2017, but that legislation was defeated. The beneficiaries certainly want to keep this perk. Demand for housewife trips this year is soaring. And that's from Lebanon. A broken shell of a country. Lebanon is running out of everything, said Liana Alamedin, and panic is gripping the people. There's no meat at the butcher, no fuel at the gas station, no medicine at the drug stores. The price of food has quintupled in a year, partly because whatever food or medicine makes it across our borders gets quickly smuggled to war-torn Syria, where it fetches even higher prices. Thanks to years of skyrocketing public debt and political paralysis, the economy ground to a halt even before the pandemic hit, with banks refusing to give customers their money. Turkey's Car Powership, which supplies one quarter of Lebanon's electricity, cut off power earlier this month because of non-payment, and so more blackouts are inevitable. The government subsidies that have allowed ordinary Lebanese to afford staples such as flour and gasoline will soon be scrapped because the dollar reserves of the Bank of Lebanon are shrinking like hell. One taxi driver waiting at a gas station said that he had heard that fuel will soon hit $12 a gallon. If his tank is empty at that point, he pledged, I'll leave my car right in the middle of the road. Most of us want our children to leave the country, even though they will likely never return. What is there for them here? Time for our feature article, The Last Word. Title this week, Having a Baby at 25. Young women are delaying childbirth for valid professional and economic reasons, said Elizabeth Brunig in the New York Times. But becoming a mother can be a way of finding yourself. If someone had asked on the day of my college graduation whether I imagine I would still be, in 5 years' time, a reliable wallflower at any given party, I would have guessed so. Some things just don't change. What I would not have predicted at the time is that 5 years hence I would be lurking along the fringes of a three-year-old's birthday party, a bewildered and bleary-eyed 27-year-old mom among a cordial flock of Tory Burch bedecked mothers in their late 30s and early 40s who had a much better idea of what they were doing than I ever have. Nobody was remotely rude to my husband and me, though our differences were fairly obvious. At most, they seemed a little surprised to find a pair of 20-somethings in a situation like ours. That much, and the dreamy gaze of one driven to distraction by love of their child, we had in common. When my husband and I compared notes after the shindig, he recounted a sly line of questioning spun by a curious partygoer that he thought was aimed at determining how, given our ages, we could afford the ritzy preschool that our daughter attended with theirs. She was trying to figure out if it's a welfare thing or a scholarship thing, he chuckled. It was the former. If Families living inside Washington, D.C., which we did at the time, are entitled to free preschool. Those living in the suburbs outside the district have to pay tuition. The fact that our little girl could spend a few hours a day learning and playing at Mayor Muriel Bowser's dime was the best part of living in the mildewy two-bedroom condo we owned, and it certainly made being young parents in a major city considerably easier. Which isn't to say that it was easy. As a rule, having and raising children is never easy. This is especially true in the United States, where, compared with similarly developed countries, parents enjoy relatively little support. And while recent conservative caterwauling over the push for subsidized child care suggests America won't be joining the ranks of the Nordic countries in terms of parental benefits anytime soon, the loss may be as much theirs as anyone's. It is, after all, the right that frets most vocally about the nation's declining birth rates. Most conservatives tend to argue that the financial concerns voiced by hesitant would-be parents are less salient than their cultural habits, like individualism. Millennials stand accused of immaturity and selfishness, of lacking the grit and commitment to bring up children who, I gather, get in the way of avocado toast and grapefruit mimosas. The reality is more prosaic. Young people are hesitant to start their families because of legitimate worries about money and stability, along with a variety of cultural concerns that, were their baby boomer parents honest, they would admit issued from their own design. There are good reasons to wait to have children and good reasons not to. It's that latter notion that I often consider but rarely mention to friends of mine who are on the fence, knowing that they are typically inundated with unsolicited advice from older acquaintances and relatives who all seem to know precisely how to fix this putatively immature, allegedly selfish generation. That kind of scolding about growing up obscures the truest thing about having children, which is that it isn't a chore, but a pleasure. Not the end of freedom as you know it, but the beginning of a kind of liberty you can't imagine. But before considering the secret lives of young parents, it's useful to establish precisely who they are and by what measure we call them young. Millennial women in the United States are waiting longer than any generation in recorded history to have children, a trend that's raised the rate of births among 30-somethings to a 50-year high. Higher education also correlates with relatively delayed birth. A 2012 Pew survey found that while 62% of women with a high school diploma had given birth by the age of 25, only 18% of women with master's degrees or higher had done the same. In fact, a solid 20% of master's degree holders celebrated their first babies at 35 or older. Unsurprisingly, these numbers track with household income. As of 2018, more than half of women living on less than $25,000 per year between the ages of 40 and 45 report having given birth by age 25. Among women banking $100,000 or more, the share was a touch over 30%. Other factors can play a role too, like race and country of origin. A 2014 Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study noted that white mothers typically give birth for the first time around age 27, and black mothers did so at roughly 24.2. Asian and Pacific Islander moms were, on average, over 29, and Mexican-American moms just under 24. And then there's geography. Along the East and West Coast, mothers tend to have their first children later than women in the middle of the country. In Washington, where I had both of my children, mothers on average welcomed their firstborn around 28.9. In Tarrant County, Texas, where I was born and raised, the age is closer to 25.7. Only a few months older than I was when my eldest daughter arrived on a dewy morning in June 2016. Taken together, the trends listed above compose a portrait of millennial delay. highly educated professionals living in major urban centers. In other words, people like me, a lily-white full-time writer with a master's degree living within rail distance of New York City, tend to postpone childbirth until their late 20s or early 30s. When surveyed, most young people report they elected to put off having kids because they wanted to make more money first, because of the high cost of child care and the burden of student debt. Others cite the price of housing, political instability, and fear of a changing climate. Millennials who had not yet had children and weren't sure if they would told the Times in a 2018 survey that they didn't want to sacrifice leisure time and they hadn't found the right partner, that they weren't certain they would make good parents. On the money front, hesitant parents-to-be are exactly right. I would know. While my husband and I were never in abject poverty, we understood what it meant to be precariously employed at the start of our careers. When I was 25 years old and 20 weeks pregnant, the magazine I wrote for was abruptly put up for sale. The attractive maternity leave policy listed in our contracts included. I wound up interviewing for a series of new jobs wearing an oversized blazer, hoping nobody would detect that I was applying for two. Reader, everyone knew. No career comes without risk, but early career precarity and minimal savings certainly raise the stakes of having kids in one's 20s. Reasonable concern about having children before establishing oneself could theoretically be remedied with a generous policy approach. The Biden administration has rightly shown some interest in nudging a few such benefits forward. These proposals are nowhere near as luxurious as those on offer in Scandinavia, but they would still be an improvement upon the American situation. But what of having children, or getting married, for that matter, before establishing oneself? That is, what to say to the young person who might consider those kinds of commitments if not for the finality of it all, the sense that she may be making somebody else before knowing who she herself really is? The standard issue airline safety warning comes to mind. In the event of an air pressure change inside the cabin, secure your oxygen mask in place before you attempt to assist other passengers you may be traveling with. They don't say, or you'll both be screwed, but you know that's what they mean. The thought certainly crossed my mind. When I got pregnant, my husband was a fledgling lawyer and I was a greenhorn journalist. A big night for us entailed walking to the local Popeyes to pick up a box of biscuits and a couple of tubs of red beans and rice. Our basement apartment had orange and yellow walls and a single window-mounted air conditioner with a permanent death rattle. In my memory, it is always summer there because every day passed with that languor of summer, the thrill of limitless possibility softened by a sense of no particular hurry. We both knew we were still waiting to become who we would be. This was all prelude. And then we found ourselves in a darkened room in an obstetrician's office, nervously watching an ultrasound flicker to blurry significance on a screen. The doctor pointed out a pale oblong smudge in the black field of my uterus. It looked like the ghost of a peanut. And then he adjusted some knob on the machine, and the wisp had an echoing heartbeat. Somehow, even after the surprise of the pregnancy itself, I still had the capacity to be stunned. And I was. We spent our first tranche of anxiety on material concerns. Would we need a bigger place? And if so, how would we afford it? How much could we possibly save before D-Day? How would we pay for prenatal care, seeing as I was still on my mother's insurance, which did not cover maternity care for dependents? Our jobs weren't steady. We had no idea when or if they would be, or if either of us was really in the right line of work. Worldly possessions, self-understanding, and confidence were all in short supply. Then she was born. One of the things they don't tell you about having babies is that you don't ever have a baby. You have your baby. which is to you the Ur baby, the sum of all babies. The moment they laid her damp, rosy body on my chest, I knew she would envelop my world. I had worried about that very thing. In Sheila Hetty's novel, Motherhood, the narrator, a cynical writer contemplating whether to have kids before it's too late, laments the absence of new parents from their friends' lives, a phenomenon she calls that relieved and joyful desertion. When a person has a child, she writes, they are turned towards their child. The risk of falling off the world haunted me. When you have a baby, you do turn towards your child. That relieved and joyful desertion may eventually affect your friends, but at first affects yourself. What I didn't understand, couldn't have at the time, was that deserting yourself for another person really is a relief. My days began to unfold according to her schedule, that weird rhythm of newborns, and the worries I entertained were better than the ones that came before, more concrete, more vital, less tethered to the claustrophobic confines of my own skull. For this member of a generation famously beset by anxiety, it was a welcome liberation. Being young or young enough still not to know yourself entirely, and then feeling the foundation of your nascent selfhood shift beneath you, perhaps that's exactly the sort of momentous change that makes the whole enterprise so daunting. Yet there I've given up the game, with the exception of perhaps a few immutable characteristics. You are not something you discover one day through trial and error and interior spelunking. You are something that is constantly in the process of becoming, the invention of endless revolutions. You never know who you are, because who you are is always changing. You catch glimpses of yourself in time, when life shines through your inner world like a prism, illuminating all the sundry colors you contain. It isn't possible to disentangle the light from the color, the discovery of change from the change itself. And I think that's all right. At 25, I nursed my newborn daughter at sunrise in a fifth-story apartment in Washington, dreamily wondering what had become of me, an erstwhile child myself. I searched her beautiful face. It's hard to discern much in their features at that age, young and unformed as they are. But she peered up at me from the shadow of my shoulder, and I could see the umber of my own eyes taking shape in hers. There I am, I thought. There I am. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. Couple of health and science articles for you. Get ready for a noisy cicada summer. After 17 years of underground hibernation, trillions of cicadas are starting to hatch across the East Coast and Midwest, and the noise is going to be cacophonous. Brood X, which will emerge in 15 states stretching from Tennessee to New York, is one of 15 periodical broods in the U.S. Unlike annual cicadas, which appear in small groups, these chunky 1.5-inch-long insects draw strength from numbers. Swarming out in mass gives the bugs an advantage against their many predators. Birds, lizards, raccoons, snakes, and even domestic cats and dogs will eat them, and increases the odds that enough will survive to produce the next generation. Once the cicadas have pushed their way above ground, they shed their nymphal exoskeleton and become winged adults, and then go on the hunt for mates. Males try to find a partner by thrumming a love song that can be louder than a leaf blower. After 4 to 6 weeks of chirping and mating, the exhausted adult bugs die, carpeting the ground with their rather stinky carcasses. Meanwhile, the eggs they have laid in trees will hatch and the nymphs will drop to the ground, burrow into the soil, and spend the next 17 years sucking on nutritious tree roots. Although some people are terrified of these red-eyed bugs, cicadas are utterly harmless. They really can't hurt you, biologist Martha Weiss tells Bloomberg.com. They want to sing, mate, have babies, and then they're going to be gone. Another sound article, the sound of space. Because sound can't travel through a vacuum, it's long been thought that the depths of space must be a silent expanse. But new data from NASA's Voyager 1 probe has revealed that the vast regions between star systems actually have a unique soundtrack, a quiet hum caused by the constant vibration of small amounts of interstellar gas. Voyager 1 set off from Earth in 1977, and in 2012 became the first man-made object to leave our solar system. The craft's plasma wave system had previously picked up the sound of the sun's solar flares crashing through the heliopause, the boundary of our solar system. Between those eruptions, researchers have now detected a steady and persistent signature. The interstellar medium is like a quiet or gentle rain, study co-author James Cordes from Cornell University tells CNN.com. Scientists say this discovery should help them better understand how the heliosphere, which is formed by solar winds and acts as a protective bubble for the solar system, can be changed by interstellar conditions. And here on the technology page, we have the innovation of the week. Engineers have designed a computer processor that thwarts hackers by randomly changing the microarchitecture every few milliseconds, said Michael Irving in NewAtlas.com. The microarchitecture of a processor is like its guts, executing the instructions that software needs to run on a device. Hackers need to understand it to inject malware. But researchers at the University of Michigan designed a processor nicknamed Morpheus that shuffles essential information about its microarchitecture, such as the commands that the processor executes or the format of program data. A system running on the processor was mocked up to resemble a medical database filled with software vulnerabilities. More than 500 security researchers were invited to hack it, yet not a single hack made it through the defense. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page to round out the hour. Start with an article titled, Vaccination, America's Great Divide. The data on COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths tell a tale of two Americas, said Dan Keating and Leslie Shapiro in the Washington Post. Those who've been vaccinated and those who haven't. In the big picture, COVID is in rapid decline, with half of U.S. adults now fully vaccinated, and new cases plunging to their lowest point in nearly a year. But that great news obscures a far less optimistic reality. The virus continues to rage among those who haven't received a shot. In rural parts of Washington State, for example, the case rate among the unvaccinated is as high as it was in late January, near the peak. There are also spikes among the unvaccinated in Colorado, Maine, and Michigan. The vaccinated can resume their lives, said Washington Secretary of Health Umar Shah, but among the unvaccinated, you're going to have the pandemic continue. The numbers reveal a striking red-blue divide, said Peter Sullivan in TheHill.com. The 21 states with the highest vaccination rates all voted for President Biden in 2020, while deeply red states are bringing up the rear. In liberal Vermont, 70% of residents have gotten at least one shot, with most other New England states in the 60s. But the vaccination rate in Mississippi is just 34%, and it's only slightly higher in Alabama and Louisiana. There's another way to see the split, said David Leonard in the New York Times. It's based on class. Across every group, whites, blacks, Democrats, Republicans, those without college degrees are more suspicious of government and health officials and are less likely to have received a vaccine. The illness and death they face is likely to aggravate the extreme inequality that has already left working-class Americans with chronic disease, high rates of substance abuse, and dropping life expectancy. For the unvaccinated, this could be the most dangerous moment in the pandemic, said Dhruv Kular in The New Yorker. Until now, they've been protected by mandates and social norms and have kept people masked and distanced. But as the vaccinated resume normal life, unvaccinated people will drop all precautions and may continue to infect one another. The fallout may come next winter when a seasonal spike that could kill tens of thousands of unvaccinated Americans. The pandemic is coming to an end, said Tara Sonnenschein in The Hill, but sadly, it will have a very uneven ending. Hannah Jones, canceled by the right? Nicole Hannah Jones just got canceled by a powerful conservative cabal, said Siva Bonhodgetin in The Guardian. The black New York Times journalist and principal author of that newspaper's 1619 Project was up for a tenured professorship at her alma mater, the University of North Carolina's Journalism School. But conservatives on the Board of Trustees overrode the recommendation of the faculty, and Hannah Jones was downgraded to a five-year contract without tenure, a clear slap at the award-winning journalist's race, gender, and unwillingness to bow to critics. The 1619 Project triggered furious blowback on the right because the collection of essays by historians, activists, and journalists put slavery and its legacy at the center of American history. Hannah Jones surely met the requirements for tenure, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic, with 20 distinguished years as a journalist, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and a Pulitzer Prize for the 1619 Project. But conservatives wanted to punish her personally for persuasively arguing that black inequality today is the product of centuries of deliberate political and policy choices. In other words, systemic racism. Hannah Jones did not deserve tenure, said George Leff in National Review. The 1619 Project was riddled with historical errors, including its astounding assertion that the American Revolution was fought mainly to protect slavery. After that and other inaccuracies were pointed out by historians and scholars, Hannah Jones resorted to evasions and attacks on her critics while quietly changing online versions of the project. Not what a university should expect of a faculty member. Hannah Jones wasn't canceled for her political views, said John Hood in the McDowell News of Marion County, North Carolina. Most professors at UNC are left of center. So if the university's trustees are applying an ideological litmus test, they're doing a horrible job. It was her conduct in denying errors while removing them that was at issue. Hannah Jones' record is deeply flawed, said Andrew Sullivan in andrewsullivan.substack.com. But her sudden demotion was a mistake. It's imperative to oppose the cancellation of those whose views you despise. Hannah Jones represents a new form of woke journalism, the belief that journalists and scholars should be guided not by facts, but by moral clarity and the narrative of oppression. Our only defense against these deeply illiberal ideology is to stick to liberal principles. Let Hannah Jones speak and prove her wrong. And a few short pieces to round out the show. Tinder, OkCupid, Match, and six other dating sites are promoting vaccination by adding features that allow users to include their vaccination status on their profiles and filter matches by vaccination status. OkCupid officials said that people who already mentioned their vaccination status in their profiles are 14% more likely to get a match. The U.S. faces an unusually active hurricane season for the sixth year in a row, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Last year's was the North Atlantic Basin's most active season on record, with 30 named storms and 7 major hurricanes. This season, the NOAA forecasts 13 to 20 named storms and 3 to 5 major hurricanes. More than 70 Capitol Police officers have left the force since the January 6 insurrection, and many of the remaining officers are thinking of quitting, union officials say. Last week, the House narrowly passed a bill providing $1.9 billion in funding for increased Capitol security, including hazard pay, retention bonuses, and better training. On the poll watch, a majority of Americans think that police do not treat Americans equally, including 84% of blacks, 67% of Asians, 62% of Hispanics, and 53% of whites. We'll finish the show with a quote by Albert Einstein, from Albert Einstein, who says, "Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.